Today I thought I would talk a little bit about the two sutras that we chanted this morning. I don't know how familiar you are with the Heart Sutra and the Metta Sutra. They're classics in the Buddhist world. The Heart Sutra is a classic in the Soto Zen Rinzai, also Zen tradition, and the Metta Sutta in the Vipassana tradition. So if you go to Spirit Rock, you'll meet the Metta. You'll meet Metta and at many guises. And if you go to a Zen center of any kind, the Heart Sutra is chanted for at any opportunity. It's considered to be the best news. It's chanted at funerals as a way of celebration, newborn babies, births, weddings, and every kind of ordination. And every time we meet, we chant the Heart Sutra. It's so condensed, it's hard to figure out what it's talking about. But the basic message is about what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. Our mind is such a, our human mind is such a peculiar vehicle. We have learned, it's astonishing, we have learned to sort out and separate and name as distinct every item in the universe, or at least that seems to be our intention as human beings. If we really think about how the world is, if we can step aside from our tendency to name and distinguish each thing, we have to see that there's no separation from one thing to another. Everything is completely connected. It's not just an idea. If you think about your own body, where it is right now, it's sitting on something, that's sitting on something, that's sitting on something, that's sitting on something, etc., etc. That's true for every single thing. And although because of the way our mind works, we take hold of a shape or a form or a smell or a taste, and we name it. We say, this is a stick. This is definitely a stick. This is a stick of a particular kind of wood from Africa. It has a particular history. But if a dog came along, the dog would say, hey, hot dog, a toy, and chew it up. Everything that we know is provisional in that way. Everything that we identify is provisional for mainly, usually for ourself. It's part of our self-identity. I say, this is my stick. My teacher gave it to me. But that me and my are provisional in the same way that everything else is. And though it's very odd to say so, this is very good news. It means we're not stuck. We're not fixed. It means we're free. And the only thing that stands between us and our freedom is the mind that wants to hold on to things and keep them. to insist, which means that we, with that mind, we have a deep sense of separation. And from that sense of separation, a feeling of alienation. We don't quite belong. Because we think so. So the Heart Sutra starts out with Avalokiteshvara, who is the Bodhisattva of compassion. And compassion practicing wisdom, which is practicing meditation. So in meditation itself, we can begin to see how the mind just spins all kinds of stories and makes all kinds of identifications, and especially aggrandizes the great me in so many different ways, story after story. But at the same time, wisdom is being generated and giving us deep insight. The longer we sit, the more quiet we become, the more wisdom begins to arise. And we begin to see how flimsy, in a way, the whole system is that we try to make so fixed. But flimsy in the way that it's all connected. It's not that it's a vacuum. When we say form doesn't differ from emptiness, the emptiness means everything. Or it means the cup that holds. It's all of it. It's really unspeakable, unspeakably vast, and deeply intimate at the same time. And the Heart Sutra outlines all those no's. Some of them are all of Buddha's teachings of the Four Noble Truths and the interconnectedness and all of those things. It says no to all of that, meaning those are just ideas too. That there's nothing to attain. There's no place that we have to go. That we're already there. We're already here. And once we understand that, our mind is no hindrance. It doesn't get in the way. Still goes on. Still says ouch when we stub our toe. It still wants to get enough to eat and win prizes and all the things that we do in our funny life. We don't turn into some pure, fantastic spiritual being. It just becomes more real. So if mind is no hindrance, then it says no fears exist. We don't have to be afraid. It means what my teacher used to say, that it's one come down after another. We're not aiming so high anymore. We're just being life as it lives itself, as best we can, with the best heart. We depend on wisdom rather than depending on our fickle mind, which is extremely undependable, as we all know. So then the Metta Sutta is a kind of how-to. You know, if we're going to live like that, how do we do that? What kind of mind is that wisdom mind? Wisdom and compassion are really two ways of talking about our nature, our essential nature, is a mix or a different is differently expressed in different times as wisdom or compassion. And compassion. It will come out of us because it's what we are. And so the Metta Sutra is basically about the mind of compassion. Suffusing love over the entire world, above, below, and all around, without limit. That sounds extreme and very idealistic. Until we think of it as a moment-by-moment expression of ourself. It's not fancy. When you see statues of Avalokiteshvara, it often is a being with many arms, all sticking out in many different directions. You can see them in the Asian Art Museum. And each hand of the arm has a different implement on it, in it. A hoe and a pitchfork and a scissor and a knife and a baby bottle and a spoon and any implement you can imagine Avalokiteshvara has in hand. So if you drop something and your friend picks it up, that's Avalokiteshvara helping out. And the truth is, if we really slow down and watch our life, we can see how Avalokiteshvara is functioning all through the day, as us and for us, and for the whole world. It's the tree that drops the fruit. It's the friend that calls. It's the car that carries us. I live by myself these days for the last 5 or 6 years, and I like to remember this because I start thinking that I have to take care of everything myself. And I begin to feel not sure I can do this. And then I turn around and I realize, oh, I'm not doing this all myself. In any way, there's help around every corner, if not right in the middle of where we are. So Buddha means waking up. And these two sutras are kind of aids in helping us to wake up over and over again. And waking up isn't something that we do just for ourselves, just as some kind of self-improvement. Though it certainly is a good idea and something to aim for, self-improvement. But the basic sense of it is that we are our world. And how we are, as we practice the good, as the Metta Sutra says, as our mind is wholesome, and generous, that our world becomes that way. We talk about meditation as a practice. It means we do it over and over and over again. And every time it feeds us, informs us, and opens us up. So having a day like this is a gift, truly a gift. I want to save time for questions and discussion because I think it might be a good idea to. You might have some questions about the funny things that we do and about what I've said. Yes.
They seem together and yet divergent.
The word for it is shin in Chinese and Japanese. And shin means heart-mind. So you put your finger right on it. That's exactly what it is. They don't make a distinction between the two. So it's very awkward in English. We don't have a word for that that's both. And the way it's described sometimes as the mind of wisdom as a raptor soaring above and seeing the whole picture and embracing with that kind of mind a perspective on what's happening. And the mind of compassion is being smack dab in the middle of the mess and working with it and with the hope that the mind of wisdom and compassion are working together in whatever situation we find ourselves so that we can step back and step in. Yeah.
Oh. Well, what I was thinking of. I went to the Joanne Macy recently, and she talked about, you know, these times we live in and how much suffering there is.
Yes.
And our task to witness to that and to nurture whatever we could. To save, actually, whatever we could, that was part of the compassion of loving kindness.
Yes.
And even though I took that in, I find myself with my grandchildren and they're immersed in so much consumption and technology and not being judgmental, and I catch myself and I keep trying, but it's very hard. Is there any way to, how does one watch these beings I love so much doing things that I see leading them to more suffering?
One of the hardest things about our life is that, and the way we operate is that we want to hold on to things, especially the things we like a lot, like our grandchildren. And we can't. We have to let them go. Even grandchildren, which are so much fun and such a free kind of thing to be with, without the burden of parenting. But in the end, you have to let them go too.
These grandchildren are teenagers. It was much easier when they were little.
Yes, yes, I know. I have two teenage grandchildren. Mm-hmm. One of them in the army. At the age of 17, he went in. So I know what you mean.
I have one that's taken to hunting. He's killing doves.
Yep. Yep. We have to kiss them and kiss them goodbye. Over and over. With complete love. Julian?
I guess this is kind of in line with what you were saying. I mean, since, like, a lot of, I don't know, the pain I feel is from other people with, like, their suffering. And people who suffer tend to be a bit crueler. Mm-hmm. I think that goes with, that's hand in hand.
It does.
It's really hard to deal with that. I mean, you know, like, yeah. It makes me question my practice, because it's like, geez, if I can't help, or if I can't, I don't know. What good?
You can't change it, other people.
I am so much saner than, you know, it just seems,
yes.
I don't know, crazy.
Well, you might look at that idea that you're so much saner than everybody else. You know, the thing is that, in terms of the Heart Sutra, in the terms of the seamlessness of all things, that they are we. So you really can't say, you know, me and them, or us and them, because we're all in this soup together. And though you have a particular viewpoint from which you are seeing the soup of yourself, they are in the same soup. They are the same soup and are seeing things differently. But we can't separate ourselves from each other. And the judgments that we make become extremely painful for ourselves. So it's not about them. It's about how you use your mind. You don't have to make those judgments.
And that's what's essential in letting it kind of go.
Well, of doing what you can to help people feel at ease, because people who are nervous become more cruel, but to protect yourself and find a world where you can operate more as easily and as generously as you can without being overwhelmed by difficult situations. But keeping your own space and keeping your own seat.
But it just gets so tricky, because I understand it, but then I don't want to be isolated.
No.
It's just, the words are kind of hard to come up with.
I understand.
Because, I mean, when I say about, like, the sanity, it makes me question, I guess, the value of sanity, whatever is, you know, itself,
well,
or like...
Do we know what that is, even?
Yeah, like, so these concepts just seem kind of...
They're all ideas.
Yeah, without much weight.
Yes.
Yes, like everything is like falling.
Yes, yes. Well, live from your belly. Don't worry so much about what you think about things. go by your what you sense, what you feel. Your feeling can tell you a lot that your mind misses. So as I say, protect yourself, you know, make yourself safe. But then open yourself up, and I always say, have a scientific kind of mind of what is this? What is this really? You know, our quick mind is always saying, oh, it's that, that's that. You know, we think we know. But if we open it up, we begin to see there's a whole lot more inside than we think than we know. So just study it. Make it your study. Who are these people? And maybe there are people you don't want to be with. You know, it's important to find a world in which we can function in a healthy way.
Kind of makes me think of the higher, middle, and lower realms.
Mm-hmm.
And how tricky, I don't know.
Better not worry about it. We don't know which realm we're in. Probably down.
Sangha seems so present here, and it's a great joy that to me that there is a group here sitting as we are today.
Yeah.
And you know, we've been talking about Buddha, Dharma, and just to make note of Sangha and that sense of connection.
Yeah.
And the connection and the sense of the way in which when we all come together and sit in a room, we help hold each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether you have some thoughts to share about that, but it seems really important to me.
Well,
to what Julian was just saying.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, I would say we've chosen to be a part of this Sangha, but I think we've been chosen to be a part of this Sangha in some way also, that we find ourselves together in some wonderful way and can live what the teaching is without words, just living and working together in this very simple way. We just had a week-long session in Carmel, of all places, in which 18 people all met together and sat all day long. Samia was the cook, the gal who was here this morning in the corner, cooked for 18 people with a lot of help. Everybody had a job, and everybody worked together, and there was almost no talking at all. And when you come out of a situation like that, you feel so close to each other and so informed by each other and so not alone. We begin to realize in our sitting how and where we belong. And some of it is about being able to take our own seat in connection with others in a social situation. There's so many situations where we feel we have to present ourselves in some way. And in this kind of situation, we don't. And we are what we are. And you get what you get. And it's such a relief. And a wonder. And it's a gift to other people as we leave a situation like this also. Because we go, at least for a little while, with that kind of openness and freedom. And with the intention of returning in some way, of regenerating this kind of being together. And it does, it's an organic process. It really does take hold and create and recreate itself. We're so fortunate that you generated this one. Well, you had the space, you had the desire, you had the friends, you had the whole kit and caboodle.
Well, it wouldn't have happened without all of your folks and all of it, so there it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
The container, you know, that there's a way in which the heart and the mind begin to contain everything, and I was thinking that it's kind of concentric containers of the Buddha, the Sangha, and the Dharma, mm-hmm. and that we're holding the Buddha here,
mm-hmm.
and the Buddha is holding us.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's all of a piece. It's all one. I mean, we say Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but it's just different ways of turning one thing, different faces of one thing. We are Buddha. And what we say and how we are is the Dharma itself. So, it's all... It's all we've got. And it's enough. Yeah.
Would you speak to the part, I think it's in the Heart Sutra about the emptiness, no body, no time, no sight, just flows and knows. I recently read a different interpretation of that, and I don't remember it well enough to put it into the circle to reflect on it, but I'd love to hear how you hold that part of it. Is it part of the Heart Sutra?
Yes, yes, it is. It sounds astonishing when you first hear it. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. Those are all describing how we take in the world. It's the body, the very first one of five ways of examining what we are. The Buddha sort of took the human being apart and said there's form, which is the body, feeling, meaning how we take things in, how we perceive, and then what we do with it, which we call perception, and then the impulses that it creates in us to act, and then that becomes how we're conscious of the world and how we operate. So what he was saying was that they're all what it's saying in the Heart Sutra is those are all ideas also. So in the sense of the Heart Sutra, we drop them all because they're just more wiggles in our brain. But in terms of Buddhist teaching, it's also saying that even if we think of those as human beings, we have to see that they are empty, that they're constantly shifting and changing. There is no human being who isn't changing continually in all those aspects, so that we can never have even imagine that there's some fixed one of us, and that is always tending to fall apart. And will eventually fall apart. And that its basis of suffering is trying to cling and hold on to things that can't be held on to. So the whole teaching is a kernel right there in the middle of the Heart Sutra about how we are and what makes us suffer. Yes.
It's nice to be here for the second half.
I'm glad you could come.
I wanted to continue on with what Deborah brought up, which was the emptiness. And I'm not sure I really understand the vast emptiness is form, and form falls apart. I'm just confused.
Forms falls apart into something else.
Okay.
It's Thich Nhat Hanh's example of the rose is the simplest one. He says a rose grows up and looks beautiful and blooms, and then it drops, and it falls apart in the dirt and becomes all kinds of other stuff, which eventually goes into the roots of the rose and grows up and becomes another rose. That's a very simplistic way of saying it, but it means that we will fall apart and we will become, you know, all the things that we made us up in the first place will fall into all of those and then coalesce in some other way. Perhaps, maybe we'll float around in space. Who knows? We don't know. But the certainty is that we're going to fall apart.
So form is continually dissolving.
Yes. Yes, continually dissolving and continually reconstituted. So it's that kind of universe. That's what life is. That's why we have grandchildren. Yes. That's what I told my grandchildren when they were little. They said, "Oh, Oma, don't die, please, please." I said, "I have to die to make room for your children." Oh.
It's kind of like the idea of music, like you have these notes that you don't really hear, really. They're just kind of formed, mm-hmm. but until someone sounds them,
yeah.
Of course, they can't get sounded forever. I mean, it's,
but they take life and become something. Yes. Yes. That's a wonderful way of thinking of it. We're a great piece of music, but it does have an end. Yeah. Each one different. Yes.
I think as you know, this is my first.
Yes. I was going to ask you.
And as I started out, I was having a really hard time relaxing my breathing, and I was just focusing on it so much that there was no way for it to relax. So I tried not to separate it. And I tried to just let my body work with it and relax a little bit. And as I did that, it was that wholeness, not separating, but being with the breath. And it was happening before I realized that I'd let go. But it wasn't until we walked a few times that I could it just was without any effort.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice to notice.
Oh, congratulations. Good work. Yes, yes, it's the hardest thing.
It's the hardest work.
Yes. Yeah. That's great.